If Aristotle's treatise on friendship in the Nicomachean Ethics can be regarded as the theoretical basis of much later Christian writing, then the direct antecedent, especially in the Christian West, that is to say, the text which was actually read and used and cited and adapted, is the incorporation of Aristotle's insights into the Latin idiom and their expression by Cicero in his great treatise Laelius, or the De Amicitia, on friendship. This text was read throughout Christian antiquity and in the Middle Ages and remained part of the normal study of anyone studying Latin seriously up until relatively modern times. It was also used not only as a way of learning the Latin language, but also as a text in itself, which provided wonderful insights in regard to friendship. One of the great examples within Catholic history is Matteo Ricci, the Jesuit who was involved in the initial evangelization efforts in China, and who realized that in the Chinese culture, one of the texts that would help them be able to appreciate the gospel better would be precisely this one, which dealt fundamentally with the context of friendship. And so he translated, or saw to the translation of Cicero's De Amicitia into Chinese. So it's been very highly prized throughout the Christian centuries and was cited and used by monastic authors and thinkers throughout the Middle Ages, and especially in the period prior to the reestablishment of the rediscovery of Aristotle's original treatise, on which Cicero depends. So much of what we'll see here is a borrowing from, a restatement of, an adaptation of Aristotle's methodology and insights, but in the unique context which Cicero brings. Now remember, Cicero is a very different kind of person, whereas Aristotle is a philosopher who has the luxury also of being primarily a teacher, who instructs some very politically important people. Aristotle is not primarily a politician. Cicero, however, is a lawyer, a rhetor, one who argues cases in public, and a member of the Roman Senate. So he was very much involved in politics, much to his own destruction later in life. He loved the ancient republic and despaired of seeing it transformed into effectively a kingdom and an empire. And he was despised by Mark Antony, who after being verbally assaulted or attacked by Cicero following the assassination of Julius Caesar, when the triumvirate came to power, the triumvirate of Lepidus and Octavian, later to become the Emperor Augustus and Mark Antony, Antony vindictively sought the death of Cicero and achieved it. So Cicero was a victim of the politics of the time, and he knew the direction things were moving toward the end of his life, when the De Amicitia seems to have been written. So in some ways, it will carry the mindset and the opinions and the approach of one who has had to deal with the real world and the question of the difficulty of friendships and relationships in the actual context of politics and the necessity for political adaptation, as contrasted with Aristotle's rather more precise recommendations, which, at least in his experience, often were not tested in practice. And we'll see that especially when Cicero asks the question, what happens when a friend asks you to do something that isn't actually completely ethically legal? What do you do? Do you absolutely refuse, or is there a kind of a limit? So as we'll see, he's willing to make more of an accommodation on this question than Aristotle was, or than later Christian authors would be. So let's take a look at Cicero's text. Beginning, and this is, by the way, selections from it. The full text is available from the course documents section of the course if you wish to read this very important text in its entirety. But we begin, and by the way, there are two different kinds of numberings here, as we already saw, there is with Aristotle and also with Plato. There is chapter numbering, which is the larger numbers, but they're variable depending upon the version of the translation that you read. More consistent are the numbers in brackets, which are more or less the paragraph markers, and that's what I'll try to refer to. So if you look at paragraph 5 in brackets, he talks about the fact that he's dedicated his treatise on friendship To his friend Laelius, for whom the treatise is entitled, and in paragraph 12, he remarks about the fact that his friend has died, and so he's remembering a very beautiful and wonderful friendship he enjoyed, and he offers the insight, which of course Aristotle would not offer, being less certain of the question of the immortality of the soul, but Cicero has no doubts on this point. For him, the question of friendship is important because it is a relationship that actually reaches out in some sense beyond life. He asserts the souls of men are divine, and when they have quitted the body, a return to heaven is open to them, least difficult to those who have been most virtuous and just. So a friendship based on virtue or based on justice also has a kind of what a Christian would call eschatological significance or a soteriological significance in terms of where the soul is going to go and how difficult it will be for it to get there. So if we look down at number 15 in brackets, he describes his experience of friendship. Between us, there was the most complete harmony in tastes, pursuits, sentiments, which is the true secret of friendship. And he'll have all sorts of phrases here that become standard little sentences that will be quoted in the Christian literature on friendship, complete harmony in tastes, pursuits, sentiments. This becomes an important definition of our understanding of friendship. Again, we have in Cicero a less analytical, in many ways less precise, and rather more literary and poetic description of friendship. He says in number 18, friendship can only exist between the good. Nisi in bonis amicitiam. It is only among the good that there can truly be friendship, or friendship of the best kind, or friendship worthy of the name. And he goes on in number 19 in little brackets to say, we mean by the good those whose actions and lives leave no question as to their honor, purity, equity, liberality, these great traditional classical virtues, and who are thus free from the vices of greed, lust, and violence, and also people who have the courage of their convictions. You can see here the old Republican wanting to stand up for a world that he sees crumbling around him, a world worthy even in some sense of giving one's life for. So a certain amount of courage is one of the virtues that he regards as important in the context of friendship. He offers a definition in number 20 in brackets, and that's the beginnings of chapter 6 in this version. Now friendship may thus be defined a complete accord on all subjects, human and divine. And this will be quoted throughout the Christian centuries. Omnium divinarum humanarum quae rerum. Cum benevolentia et caritate consensio. A complete accord on all human and divine subjects associated with, joined with, mutual goodwill or benevolence and affection or caritas. So that's his definition of friendship. Complete accord, mutual goodwill, each wishes the good of the other, and affection or love, caritas. And he says, with the exception of wisdom, I'm inclined to think nothing better than this has been given to human beings by the immortal gods. So there is no greater good than friendship, than this complete accord on all human and divine subjects, which is coupled with mutual benevolence and charity. And then he describes in the next paragraph in the section that's highlighted, virtue is the parent and preserver of friendship. Without it, friendship cannot possibly exist. And he's described above the virtues that he considered to be most important. Now remember, with Aristotle we have the definition of friendship as a kind of virtue. With Cicero it's a rather more general statement. He's defined friendship in terms of a relationship, a quality of relationship, and virtue is the parent and sustainer or preserver of it. If we drop down then to number 22 in little brackets, how can life be worth living, which lacks the, and a beautiful phrase, the repose, conquiescit, the repose that is found in the mutual goodwill of a friend. And that's a beautiful, again, kind of poetic imagery, different from what one would find and does find in the more analytical Aristotle. It's a repose. It's as if you can kind of just kind of relax back into the goodwill of someone you know wants your good. Friendship provides a kind of opportunity for a relaxation. Friendship, he says at the end of this paragraph, enhances prosperity, relieves adversity of its burden by having and sharing it. Your friend is sharing carrying your burden. And here is why one can see that in regard to the one who offers advice in the Christian context, the spiritual advisor, the spiritual mother or father, often the one who is the recipient of that advice will see this quality of friendship in the person from whom they receive it, because their burden is lifted. Suddenly they find themselves more prosperous. Now again, it's important to realize that this is one-sided. The person receiving the advice has the right to see that aspect or part of friendship in the other, but the person who is their spiritual mother or father does not have the right to expect that they have the right to open their heart to the one to whom they offer that. That's a violation of boundaries, as we've said. So this is a very beautiful anticipation of a theme that will become important throughout the later Christian tradition. And in number 7, which is brackets 23, great and numerous are the blessings of friendship, and he'll come back to this point again. In the face of a true friend, one sees, as it were, a second self. So where their friend is, that is where we are. If the friend is rich, we are not poor. If the friend is weak, if we are weak, our friend's strength is given to us, even though in some sense we are dead, through a friend we live. A friendship carries a memory that allows a person to, in a sense, continue living, although again, Cicero believes in the immortality of the soul, so he may well believe in a continuation of relationship after death as well. So, friendship by its nature, he says in number 26, admits of no pretense, no feigning. As far as it goes, it is both genuine and spontaneous. So there is absolute honesty in friendship. If it requires pretense, then it's not really friendship. Someone, person with whose character and nature we are in full sympathy, this is a friend, because we perceive in the other what he calls the beacon light of virtue. So here he's emphasizing again the importance of virtue being what we see and prize in the other. That's what attracts us. That is what causes this sympathy of character, and not just because we are attracted to it, but because we have that within us which wishes it also. We also want to have that same kind of character, that same kind of virtue. It is mutual in terms of having the same goal. For nothing, he says, inspires love, conciliates affection like virtue. He doesn't speak in quite the same analytical or precise way in chapter 9, number 29 in brackets, of the inferior forms of friendship that we see in Aristotle, but he does speak of them in passing, that need or utility and pleasure are base motives for friendship. Because he says the attraction of goodness, probitas, of probity, the attraction of moral uprightness, is so great that we can love it not only in those whom we have never seen, but how much more will we love it in one whom we do see? That's how he begins this paragraph. And then in the highlighted text, it would be wrong, he says, it would come from a particular sense of weakness for someone to maintain or believe that friendship is born of want and poverty, that is to say, out of need or utility. If you believe that, you believe that friendship has a very base origin. So Cicero is not interested in that kind of an understanding or definition of friendship. And even worse, in little brackets 32, worse in some ways are those who refer everything to sensual pleasure, like the brute beasts. The highlighted text further down, the origin of friendship from a natural impulse is how it arises, a natural impulse, the love of the good, the morally upright in the other, rather than a sense of need, allows it to be more dignified and more in accordance with fact. So neither utility or need or want or sensual pleasure are legitimate understandings of the origin of friendship. Genuine friendships, he says, are eternal. Now, he'll modify that somewhat and say that it's hard to maintain a friendship throughout life, but this deep, this fundamental, we might vaguely remember back to Plato's definition in the Lysias, that there is this kind of primordial friend, which is a participation in the eternal that we see in the other. There may be a little hint of that, it's unclear, but he believes in the eternal quality of the very best friendships. And he talks about the fact that the very best thing would be, but at the same time, the most difficult thing might be for a friendship to remain unimpaired to the end of life. So there is a tendency towards change, a possibility of, all the things that can happen in relationships that can threaten friendship, even though it's supposed to be eternal. And in some ways, these are also the things that are threatening moral goodness, the moral goodness in oneself and the other that is reflected in this this difficulty of friendship. And he says in number 35, and he'll come back to this, wide breaches in friendship, but for the most part justifiable ones, were caused by an immoral request being made of friends to pander to a person's unholy desires or to assist them in inflicting a wrong. So the most destructive thing in friendship is to request or to be expected to participate in some wrongful act because of a commitment in friendship to another. And so he speaks in number 11 about virtue as the limit of friendship. Evil conspiracy will destroy true friendship. He says in number 38 with small brackets, perfect wisdom must be assumed on both sides if no mischief is to happen. So no bad stuff should happen. But in number 40, he says, we then lay down this rule of friendship, this lex, this law of friendship, neither ask nor consent to do what is wrong. That's the principle. Do not ask your friends ever to do what is wrong. And to do a thing for friendship's sake, he says, is a discreditable, even a perverse motive. So in number 43, there should be no such confederation of evilly disposed persons to shelter under the plea of friendship. And a sign of this, he goes on in number 44, chapter 13, 44 in little brackets. The sign of this is that when you correct a friend, they accept it gladly. And you can see that this will be an important notion in the Christian adaptation of friendship, its application to community, whether it's a parish community, a religious community. We should ask from friends and do for friends only what is good. That's kind of number one. But at the same time, there should be an absence of hesitation, and we should be able to give advice with candor, with honesty, with openness, and there should be a willingness to accept advice when it comes from a friend. So there is a willingness to accept even that which is offered, if the case demands it, he says, with sharpness. So when fraternal correction in real friendship has to happen, it should be accepted, and it should be a sign that it is true friendship, that it is accepted. So he says in 47, friendship should never come out of one's life. It would be as if you were taking the sun out of the sky, because the immortal gods have given us nothing better or more delightful than friendship. And remember, he's already said this before. This is a principle he comes back to several times. In number 48, virtue, he says, is the beginning of friendship. Nothing, he's already mentioned this, but he comes back to it again and reiterates it. Nothing so powerfully attracts and draws one thing to itself as likeness does to friendship. This is a principle not only from Aristotle, but from Plato, and even from the pre-Socratics and earlier authors. There is a quality of likeness within friendship that one is drawn to, and he wants to insist that the likeness is virtue, is goodness. It's not, he says, and here he's combating again the idea that he already raised, he's not, he says in number 51, agreeing that it is interest or utility, utilitas, that is the basis of friendship. No, he says, that destroys the most attractive link in the chain of friendship. Now in number 16, brackets 56, paragraph number 56, he's a little more flexible on the question of what happens if a friend asks you to do something that isn't actually immoral or very wrong or destructive, but may not be completely right. What about the fact that a friend might ask us to do something which is, as he puts it, reaching toward the boundary line where we're not supposed to go? Well, he offers three opinions with which he completely disagrees. One is that we should love our friend just as much as we love ourselves, that it should be an identical love. He doesn't agree with that, and no more. The second point with which he disagrees is that our affection should exactly correspond and to equal theirs. We should love a friend only as much as they love us. He doesn't agree with that. A third is that a man should be valued at exactly the same rate as he values himself. Doesn't agree with that point either. And so in contrast with that, and he gives an extensive discussion of these principles that he rejects, he says, when we undertake to enter into a relationship of friendship, we should not do it with someone we would later come to hate. And then finally he says, the real limit is that the characters of two friends must be stainless. There must be complete harmony of interests, purposes, and aims without exception, so that if the case arises of a friend's wish that is not strictly right in itself, remember that Cicero is a politician, and he knows that actually living this out may be more complicated than laying down an absolute principle, we must make some concession from the straight path, but the condition is that the extreme of disgrace is not the consequence. We must never abjure or neglect virtue. So there may be some compromise allowed in minimal, say, in the context of, again, remember, in his life, in the context of a republic that is crumbling in face of a monolithic, and he thinks destructive and horrific, empire, you might well act against the law of the state for a higher principle, and it might be friendship that would call you to do that. And then finally he says in number 65, what qualities are we looking for in stability and permanence? Loyalty, simplicity, social disposition, a sympathetic nature. And he, if you drop down a little further, that into the highlighted text in number 65, chapter 18, that the friend will be without any pretense. He's already said this before. He's repeating it again. The friend will reject all accusation brought against his friend and will not be suspicious and will be pleasant in word and manner. So he's adding other characteristics to friendship that exclude what he calls a gloomy temper or unvarying gravity. In number 69, in little brackets, he says that there is equality in friendship, almost a forced equality in friendship. Other social considerations are leveled. Again, remember, you're talking about the Republican who is upset with the creation of empire. Friendship creates a level. In friendship, in number 71 in brackets, chapter 20, he says, in friendship and relationship, those who possess any superiority must put themselves on an equal footing with those who are less fortunate, and those latter should not be annoyed at being surpassed in rank by a friend. So, finally, he says in number 78, friendship to be sought only for its own sake, that is to say, and if you look at the highlighted text, friendship is sought without any ulterior object, and he repeats again, tamquam alter idem. Your friend is, as it were, a second self. They are like a second self. So, man not only loves himself, but seeks another whose spirit, and another beautifully phrased, he may, metaphorically speaking, blend with his own, as if to make one being of two, cum suo misciat, unum ex duobus, that you are blending, as it were, the other's goodness with your own, and it's as if the two are becoming one in friendship. So, in 25, he excludes subservience, flattery, adulation, base compliance. There's honesty, openness, willingness to give and to receive advice, even if it's difficult to hear sometimes. And then he concludes in chapter 27, virtue creates and preserves friendship, and on it depends, in a fascinating series of three, harmony of interest, permanence, fidelity, and I've just noted in passing that these are very similar, intriguingly, to the Benedictine vows of the monastic way of life, the conversatio morum, stabilitas, or stability and obedience. So Cicero's text is destined to have great popularity and use throughout the Christian centuries, as we shall see, but to be adapted and modified by such individuals as Ambrose, John Cassian, and Gregory the Great, and then especially in his great treatise on friendship, St. Aelred of Rivaux.